gentlemen, I would like to start by thanking people. My projectionist at the back, because I shall always forget him at the end. The British Council for having paid my fare to Australia and also back again. AIP and IE Ost and Dr. McCracken's COSA for providing the logistics for getting around Australia and the means for sleeping and eating. And also for the space associations in Australia who've kindly invited me to speak to them. And thank you last of all to you for coming along tonight. I don't know about educating you, but if I entertain you, then my coming will not have been in vain. I see that to get into here, it's rather easier for a camel to pass through an eye of a needle than to escape the man at the door who's demanding the entry fee. I hope at the end you don't sort of rein him and ask for your money back. I'm going to turn the lights out and have her. I've got my proper glasses on. The first slide is a NOAA picture of Scandinavia. And I put this on for a couple of reasons. First of all, it shows cloud cover. And secondly, it shows you part of the world that you don't usually see from Australia. You can recognise here Denmark, Copenhagen here, Stockholm up there, the Gulf of Riga, and going into the Gulf of Bosnia up there, and the Norwegian fjords together with the cloud cover. This is Scotland. Here is England, Flamborough Head. This is the Wash. Kettering is just about where my finger is at the bottom here. We're 72 miles north of London, and we're roughly midway between Oxford and Cambridge in the east-west direction. You can't get much further from the sea. Now, weather forecasting by satellites is well known, and I won't insult you by talking about that anymore. The Russians have their meteor satellites. They transmit on 137.3, 137.4, and 137.85 megahertz. And two of them are operating at the moment, and we picked them up at Rowley Stone in Western Australia on a fortnight ago today. So, yes, we're all used to the weather pictures. I've been watching your weather forecast. There seems to be a very mad weather forecaster on Channel 9 who talks about crocodiles near Darwin. I'm not sure how they come into the weather forecasting pattern, but I'm assured it's a boomer up there, whatever that means. And we now move on to the next slide, which gives us some data, special southern hemisphere data, collated for trip to Australia. And what it shows there is that without satellite data, the accuracy of a weather forecast in the southern hemisphere is only 1.5 days. But if you add the satellite data to it, you can double the accuracy, or you can double the accuracy for double the time for 3 days. For the northern hemisphere, we don't get such an improvement because we have many more ground reporting stations in the northern hemisphere. So we were getting 3.5 days accuracy without the satellites. With the satellites, we can push it up to 4.5 days. So there's just some figures which you might find interesting. The next slide gives you an idea of the costs. The total costs of meteorological satellites are $550 mega Australian. The Radio Song programme, $300 mega Australian. And the weather forecasting benefits for airlines using the forecast for good tailwinds and jet streams, particularly in the North Atlantic, crossing between America and Europe, if they can find where the jet stream is and go with that, they can save up to $150 mega Australian a year. And hurricane damage in the United States without the satellite warning would amount to 1.5 gigabucks. So those are some sort of gee whiz data which you might find interesting. I'm sorry I turned them into Australian dollars because I've been informed that you're very used to dealing with American dollars, but to turn them into Australian dollars I had to convert the American dollars into English sterling and then back into Australian. Then they're rounded off. And I apologise for the slides. I made those the day before I came. They're just photographic negatives. And I apologise for the grey on grey. Next slide deals with earth resources. And this is a thematic mapper picture from Landsat 5, which has been treated, and I'm not allowed to tell you where it is. Not because it's militarily classified, but it's a commercial secret, because these people have competitors. The green area at the top there is a large military training area, not far from the city with the largest, tallest cathedral spire in the United Kingdom. And if you travel along this road here, if you look at the reflection of the shadow of my finger, if you travel along this road, you see it diverts there into a V4. And just in here is a large prehistoric stone circle which has special significance for the Druids on Midsummer's Day. And really all I've done is to show you that you can get very good earth resources imagery if you treat it well. The next slides show GWIS data about remote sensing. The total cost of remote sensing worldwide is 3 gigabucks annually. But last year, 15% of Landsat costs were recouped by sales, and of that, 1/5, or 3% of the total, came from the private sector. The other 12% came from the military and the government sectors. The next slide goes really southern hemisphere and tells you the cost of the New Zealand land survey. Landsat is $3 New Zealand per square kilometre, and if you wanted to survey conventionally using aircraft and ground measurements, it would cost $20 New Zealand per square centimetre, square kilometre. The next slide takes us away from remote sensing to this picture of Cosmos 1500 taken at the Paris Air Show. This is an oceanographic satellite with a lot of sensors on board, scanners, side-looking radar, synthetic aperture radar, two very small solar panels for a satellite of that size. And the next picture shows the sort of imagery which we can receive in the United Kingdom. This is a Cosmos 1602 image. No, this is Cosmos 1726, the latest one. And down the right-hand side, you have numerical data. The 0456 is minutes after midnight Moscow time, so that is 7:36 Moscow time, or 0436 GMT. And you have various housekeeping numbers down the side. You can see it changes by one every minute. This section here is a visible section, cloud cover. You can see the actual pixels. Now the pixels, because this has been recorded on a frame store, a carrier frame store, and played back through an ordinary television picture, so you've got a large amount of cloud cover. Here you've got the side-looking radar, and you can just see the outline of the white sea up there. If you look, there's the white sea coming in there. And over on this side, you have a very weird picture, which is a microwave interferometer picture, and it was not immediately recognisable. But when we worked out the ground tracks, we realised that that was the Gulf of Bothnia, which you saw on the first slide, and the Gulf of Finland going up to Helsinki, but for some reason or another, it's transmitted into mirror image. It's the wrong way round. Anyhow, the Russians can always turn it back again, and I don't suppose it bothers. But as this satellite moves along, it synthesises this image, and you can receive this on 137.4 megahertz at 4 lines a second. The next slide shows another one of these pictures. This is the synthetic aperture radar picture of the Gulf of Riga. Here is the town of Gdansk, and this is Kaliningrad. This is the radar clutter from the buildings, and the interesting stuff here is the state of the sea. It was a rough sea in the Baltic. I thought perhaps these were pictures you might not have seen down under. So this particular satellite, Cosmos 1726 at the moment, is earning its keep by looking at the state of the ice field along the northern coast of the Soviet Union, and they're keeping open a sea lane there from Murmansk and Archangel round to Vladivostok using icebreakers like the Lenin, and checking on the progress of it using this particular satellite, amongst others. If you know your geography, there is a sort of a large sand spit here which continues up there, and that is also visible in this picture. So we've got oceanography again as a civilian use, but of course there are some military uses for it as well. It's a job to know where to draw the line. The next slide shows Cosmos 1000. This was the first satellite to be identified by the Russians as a navigation satellite. And these satellites fly in constellations of four at 45 degrees, which gives you 180 degrees around the Earth, and as they're polar, it gives you global coverage. We've been able to decode the satellite message from these satellites. It comes in at 50 bits a second for 2 minutes, so there are 6,000 bits to decode. And the Russians, although that's called Cosmos 1000, they called that one number 12, because 11, 12, 13 and 14 are the numbers given to their civil satellites. And 2 weeks ago we picked up three of those satellites in Western Australia. They transmit on 150 megahertz sharp, dead. And that's narrowband FM. There's also a military system of six satellites at 30 degrees separation, which is the other 180 in the other hemisphere, and they take the identity numbers 1 to 6. When they replace a satellite, if they're going to replace number 3, the new satellite is called number 3, and the old satellite takes on the number 7 or 8, which are spare numbers. And we picked up one of those a fortnight ago because the Russians can't switch it off. It was launched in 1983 and it was replaced in 1984, and it failed in the middle of 1984, and it went round broadcasting its position as if it had sort of stopped in orbit, which I think is impossible. And it's a great embarrassment for the Russians, because the standard time signals which it's transmitting, the clock on board is losing time and it's now nowhere near correct. Now, because it is still transmitting in a rogue satellite, they have to put this in the almanac of all the other active satellites, because a Russian submarine commander must know which is the rogue satellite, otherwise when he lights the blue touch paper he might land his missile in Red Square, and that probably would not get him an order of Lenin but a one-way ticket to Siberia. The next slide shows another use of these navigation satellites. You can recognise Cosmos thousand, this sort up here, the long gravity gradient boom. This is known as COSPAS, and with the NOAA type of satellite over here, you have SARSAT. So COSPAS SARSAT is a search and rescue system operated by the Soviet Union, the United States, with help from France and Canada. Britain also has a ground readout station, and it's operated by the Coast Guard Service from Falmouth in southern part of England. And the system works. It's saved over 700 lives to date since it was first instituted. You may have heard of our madman Chay Bly, who rode across the Atlantic and sailed around the world. He got shipwrecked off Cape Horn not so long ago, and as the satellite went by, it treated him as a stationary source, and it was a mobile observer. It measured the Doppler shift from his EPIRB, his emergency position indicating radio beacon, and worked out where he was, and when it got to the northern hemisphere it said that it had found a distress signal at this particular location. The radio information was sent back to the Argentine and they went out and rescued him. Now that is not good news for sailors who get shipwrecked near Australia. The satellite do have to go to the northern hemisphere to say that you're shipwrecked. Then the message has to come back to Canberra, and Canberra has to work at the Canberra normal speed, and by that time the fellow's probably dead. So it might be an idea for Australia to join the COSPAS SARSAT program as an associate member and build a ground station down here, because you do have a large number of small boat sailors and a fair amount of water around your coastline. You also have a vast amount of unoccupied territory over which aircraft fly, and you never know, it might be well worthwhile having a COSPAS SARSAT ground station in Australia. But I'm sure the wise men in the East have thought all about that. The next slide shows an EPIRB. This is the sort of beacon which gets tossed overboard when you sink, and it broadcasts. And I really only took that picture because it's the first time I saw the patch, the COSPAS SARSAT patch. Now, I've left it in there because it allows me to tell an interesting little story which proves that the system works. They found one of these on top of a wardrobe in a council house on the site in Glasgow. And all our emergency services were out looking for this distressed sailor or airman, and it turned out that the guy who had got this beacon had stolen it from an oil rig in the North Sea. And somehow it began to transmit, and they located it, and all the police cars converged on him. He was convicted at Ipswich Crown Court and is now serving time in the United Kingdom. But there's graphic proof that the COSPAS SARSAT system and the EPIRBs do work. The next slide brings me to another navigation system. This is the American Navstar system, which is a passive system. On board the Navstars, you have clocks, very accurate clocks, and you compare it with your clock. The time of transmission, the reception of signals from three satellites will give you an XY fix to within a few metres, and if you've got four satellites above the horizon, you can get X, Y, and Z and actually find your position to, as I say, a few metres. I was at a conference in London some years ago where they were talking about 10 centimetre accuracy. And I began to wonder what was the point, because if you know your position within 10 centimetres down here, do you know where your signal is coming from to 10 centimetres up there? Because the orbit, I think, refers to the centre of mass of the satellite, and yet the signal is probably coming from the electrical centre of the antenna. And they may be more than 10 centimetres apart. This was supposed to have originally 24 satellites in three orbital planes, but as you know, the Americans are hard up, and so they've reduced it to 18 satellites. They're even worse than that now, because they only have 7 operating out of the 11 that have been launched, and of course they have no means at the moment of launching the others. So they are busily waiting for some means of putting up the remaining Block 2 Navstars, which also carry something called IONS, which is a device for detecting nuclear explosions. So the Navstars do have some sort of a military purpose. The Russians have a similar system, referred to as GLONASS, but they launch these satellites in the Cosmos program 3 at a time. Now, until the most recent launch, the 8th launch, at least one of those 3 payloads has failed in that it doesn't stabilise its ground track to repeat every 8 days, it tumbles in attitude, and it doesn't transmit. At the first launch, 2 of them failed. But some people have suggested that these may not be failures. If there's always one that fails, perhaps it's not a navigation satellite, perhaps it's something else. Well, that theory has been knocked on the head, because the last launch produced 3 which actually work. Or on the other hand, perhaps they've got enough of the ones which don't work up there to do what they want them to do. And when you ask yourself what that might be, you might consider space mines. Because these Russian GLONASS satellites also go into 2 planes at 120 degrees separation in the test phase. And one of those planes is identical to a Navstar plane. And I'm sure that the Russians don't just use Russian signals, they use the Navstars and their satellites, so they have a constellation of 3 planes, they probably have a little switch on the receiver which says ours and theirs, and they operate between them. They used to do that with the Meteor satellites in the early days. If they had a NOAA satellite or a Tyros satellite above the horizon at the same time as a Meteor, they would switch the Meteor off and take the American pictures. They don't do that these days, they're very happy with what they get. But they certainly are not loath to use American data. Now, remember that this is a civil system. It does have 2 codes. It has a precision code, which the military use, which gives you very good accuracy. The other is a random access code, a civil code, which is not such accuracy. But if you look at the next slide, you will see what I mean about it being a totally civil system, because at the Farnborough Air Show, there you see a Navstar up there, being used to direct a missile to the bullseye on the target, and that's the patch which Texas Instruments were giving away. So, as I say, it's very difficult to draw the line between a civil and a military satellite. If the Australian Army decides to send a telephone message through OSAP from Perth to Sydney saying, please send 200 pairs of socks, does that make OSAP a military satellite? It just depends how you look at it. And I'm not here to preach the gospel of military space or civilian space. I'm here to tell it as I see it and let you make up your own mind. The next picture is not of a civil or... Well, actually it is a civil satellite. It's a Russian Cosmos satellite carrying the Stars and Stripes. This is one of their bio-Cosmos satellites, and I believe you had a bio-Cosmos at your Cosmos exhibition. This is the one which had the cages for the white rats. Here are the cages for the white rats. And some of the cages were on an artificial turntable to produce artificial G, a centrifuge, and the others were not, for comparison. What I'm showing you this for is that we're pretty sure that this is the basis of the first three generations of Russian photographic reconnaissance satellite. The 2 metre diameter sphere is almost identical to the sphere in which Yuri Gagarin and the first 8 Russian manned space flights held, the same as the Vostok and the Voskhod. And instead of holding men, it holds cameras loaded with film. And these are recovered after flights these days of about 2 weeks. And we hear them come down on their parachute over Kazakhstan, 3,000 miles away, because they transmit the recovery beacon on 19.995 megahertz. We can tell how good the Australian field placing, the Russian field placing is. If they've got the field in close, then the signal switches off about 2 or 3 minutes after it reaches the ground. But if they've got them wide, sort of to save the fours with Ian Botham in, then it takes several hours for them to switch it off. We did have one which actually transmitted until the middle of the night, and whether it just died or whether they located it or not, we don't know. On the front, you see a scientific pickerback payload, which carries sign of the instruments, and that's got active thermal control with these louvers which open and close. At the back, you've got the retro engine, and on the top, you see the whip antenna, because these things transmit on 19.989 megahertz. But I guess they won't transmit over Australia unless you can pick up the signals on the final orbit. They used to transmit all the way around on the last orbit, and that's why I recruited my cousin who was in Fiji with a radio to prove that for me way back. Reconnaissance satellites. Yes, we've had 28 Russian reconnaissance satellites this year to date, or 2 last night. 5 of these are said to have Earth resources roles, but the telemetry is indistinguishable from the military ones, so I guess they have a dual role. But even if you take 5 off 28, you've still got 23 photographic reconnaissance satellite launches out of a Soviet total so far of 81. So 23 out of 81 purely photographic reconnaissance. The next slide shows how they were able to look at the Middle East war. This is a particularly interesting satellite, Cosmos 600. On the first day, it didn't overfly the Middle East, but on the second day, on Rev 15, you see it went up the east of Sinai. The next day, Rev 31, it overshot, so they lowered the apogee. That the following day it came back to Rev 47 and went right over Suez. And the next day, Rev 63 over Sinai and the Golan Heights. And then they thought, well, we really want to look at Suez, so they raised the apogee again, and Rev 79 went up here, Rev 95 went up there. And as you can see, that flew for only 7 days instead of 14. So it's a sort of an RE shuffle, you know, sort of there, and there again, looking at the target. We were able to see the war in the Golan Heights finish because the first satellites launched to look at that particular war flew at an inclination which took them first of all over Suez and then over the Golan Heights. Now, the third satellite flew at a different inclination which went only over Suez and missed the Golan Heights. And we knew that the war there was over, and the next day the Israelis said that the war was over and that they were moving their troops from Golan down to Suez. There was another interesting satellite which flew over there with rather a high perigee. Now, that's unusual. If you want a close look, then you want to get down low and look. This particular one was flying higher than usual. And it wasn't until we asked ourselves why, and we worked out that flying at that increased height, when it was over the target area, it was also within view of the tracking station at Yevpatoria in the Crimea. And so the Russians were getting digital imagery in real time from over the battlefield. It may have only been a test, but at least they've tested their system under battle conditions. Now, what can you see from up there? I used to show a very fuzzy picture taken by Landsat, I suppose. Was it Landsat? But it's one of the MacDill Air Force Base in Florida, where you could actually see aeroplanes on the runway. But we don't need to do that now, because we've got these pictures of an aircraft carrier, a Russian aircraft carrier, being built at the Nikolaev shipyards in the Black Sea. Now that is really good, and as you can see, it's a very large aircraft carrier, so large that they're having to build it in two halves. And when it's sharp here, you can see the sharp end. This is the bow of the aircraft carrier. Two great big gantries. Notice that thing at the far end, because on the next picture it's different. The second half is being built here, and what they're going to do when they've constructed the two halves, they're going to float them out into the sea and weld them together. I hope it works. What I'm showing you this for is to show you the sort of quality that the Americans can get from the KH-11 satellite. And here, this line along here is typical two-ring layer barbed wire, typical of the barbed wire surrounding Russian military emplacements. The sea looks strange too, doesn't it? It's made up of what we call wallpaper. And the sea doesn't come in strips like wallpaper or like a lawn. This is digitised imagery. And this is taken at a slant range of about 430 kilometres. The next picture is taken from vertically over, shows the same thing. Now again, you can see the ship's much better here. Where's the sharp end? There's the sharp end. This is the twin layer of barbed wire, don't look? And notice how that thing is now moved to this end, so it's taken on a different day. Now the guy who stole these, his father's a retired American admiral. He worked for the US Navy, and how did that go back?
Because I wanted to see the picture.
He wanted to see the picture. Who's running this lecture? And he thought that by giving these pictures to Jane's Defence Weekly, he might get himself as a full-time job as an editor for Jane's Fighting Ships. All he got himself was a stretch inside American jail. But I was very grateful to him, because you can actually see vehicles on another one of the pictures I've got, and people who really look at this say that it is possible, in some cases, they think they can see faces in windows. I've not seen that, because you remember this is a slide taken from a second generation print. I didn't have the first generation print, I had a copy. But it's interesting, the sort of stuff that you can see. And if the Americans can see that, I expect the Russians can see the same sort of things. Oh, there's another ship over here. But there's two halves which they're going to join together.
Two halves of one ship.
Yeah, and then another ship. I wasn't bothered about that. There's also some barges around like that. Are you ready to go on now at the back? Hey! This is a picture of the Salyut space station at the back, and on the front we have Cosmos 1443, a large Salyut type module which was docked to it. And coming up from the back we have a Soyuz T spacecraft over the Sakhalin Peninsula, the sort of area where Korean Airlines disappeared. I'm showing you this because Aviation Week said that Cosmos 1267, the second of these large modules, and the first of Dr. Salyut 6, was a battle station with potted missiles using infrared homing devices. Now, how did they know? Well, they probably photographed it with a KH-11. And if you look in this sort of an area here, you can see just two cylinders undercover. And there are more cylinders around. There are three of those around. And in fact, when the Russians released the pictures, you could see that these were fuel tanks, because you can see the plumbing bringing the fuel out to the modules. And that's where everybody's potting missiles from. On the front, what looks like a Gemini is a return capsule. And this return capsule has got a capability of delivering up to half a tonne of cargo back to Earth. And in fact, that particular one delivered, I think it was something like 350 kilograms instead of the 500 kilograms. They didn't use it to its full capacity. At the moment, up there, we've got Salyut 7, and docked to that, we've got Cosmos 1686, which apparently doesn't have a recovery module on it. Some people say it has a telescope. I've no idea what it's got on the front, but it's certainly slightly different. That is something which you can monitor in Australia. It's transmitting all the time on 19.954 megahertz shortwave, CW, pulse duration modulation. And the telex I got under my door at 10 past 11 last night said, "Salute and Mir still in the same place, Salute heard this morning, max." So it was transmitting yesterday, so I guess it's still transmitting today. They've parked Salute now in a fairly high orbit, and they intend to leave it there, I suppose, until both the systems actually deteriorate. This is a painting by a man called Sokolov. It comes from the back cover of a Russian magazine called Ogonyok. This brings me back to communications. We're all used to communication satellites, things like OSAT, things which bring us TV programmes from around the world. And of course there are such things as military communications. What you should be looking at is this thing here. That is the mobile dish which was erected in the Falklands, and the Royal Corps of Signals asked me to give you their apologies for the poor quality of the picture. They had other things to do at Ajax Bay. But it was that satellite link through an American Discus 3 over the Indian Ocean which enabled the command centre at Norwood, just outside London, to maintain real-time contact with the Falklands Task Force. And of course there are various kinds of communications. The ordinary voice communication, facsimile, things like that. But the Soviet Union operates, as well as the geosynchronous satellites, it operates semi-synchronous satellites in highly elliptical orbits in what is called their Molniya system. The Molniya goes into an elliptical orbit with a period of just under 12 hours. The apogee is 40,000 kilometres in the northern hemisphere, and the perigee of about 600 kilometres in the southern hemisphere. What that means is that the satellite sort of dawdles around apogee and gives them about 8 hours from Moscow to Vladivostok, and then sort of belts around Australia because they don't want to talk to anybody down here. And by having, at the moment we've got 8 Molniya 1s and 8 Molniya 3s, all at 45 degrees spacing, giving them a remarkable communications capability. They also have what we call stored up satellites. Satellites which will take a message, store it, and then dump it when it gets to the right KGB agent in a different part of the world. Just before the Shah of Persia was overthrown, Savak, his sort of secret police, arrested an Irani sitting by a dike outside Tehran, operating what was supposed to be a calculator with a Nixie tube type of display, and they found he was actually picking up coded signals from a Russian satellite as 5-digit groups and writing them down. Now, we tried to chase that story through the report on the Daily Telegraph, or Sunday Telegraph, who wrote it, but unfortunately the Ayatollah took power about the same time. Savak was disbanded and all the evidence was lost, because I wanted to know what time they arrested this guy, because I could have then told what satellite he was listening to, and I also wanted to know the length of his antenna, because if I'd known that, I could have worked out the frequency. I don't mind that now, because I've found the frequency since then. But the Russians do operate a constellation of stored up satellites in orbital planes spaced at 120 degrees. You may think that gives you 3 satellites. We thought so until this year, when we discovered that there are 2 satellites operating in each plane. So they do have 6 satellites operating, and Mark asked me the other day where I'd published. There was a letter by Cliff Ramp to myself in Aviation Week a few weeks back about use of 2 satellites in orbital planes. They also have tactical communication satellites. They launch 8 at a time into orbit at 74 degrees inclination, and we reckon about 24 of these are operating at any one time, so usually one of those is above the horizon, so the Russian commander can order 200 pairs of socks through one of those instead of through Ekran or Gorizon. And it was one of these satellites which the Russians launched on Friday, as I predicted last night that they probably would have launched something last Friday. They launched 8 satellites with 1 payload, and it has now taken us up to Cosmos 1801, and that's a lot of Cosmoses. So you have the various tactical, strategic, ordinary communication type of satellites. We now come to the next slide, but one, because we've already had that, and we now move on to SDI. And I've put the patch up there because the SDI patch is a shield. SDI, as conceived, was non-aggressive. And if you go back to what President Reagan said in March 1983, he said, wouldn't it be nice? And if he stopped there, I think everybody would have agreed with him. And his idea was that it would be nice if they could produce a shield against incoming missiles, which he would share with the Russians, with his friends the Russians. Now, all right, but there were skeptics who produced the next slide, and this gave us another viewpoint. And we then move on to the last slide, which I want to show before I throw it open to questions. This is another happier use of space, coming back to a possible use of building a large solar cell array in space to collect energy from the sun, converting it to microwaves, beaming it down to an antenna farm situated at a safe distance from the community, if you don't want to microwave all your community, and then converting it back again to power to supply the thing. The Office of the Department of Energy in the United States and the Office of Technology Assessment did studies on this and concluded that the technology was not yet available to do that. Now, I'll put the lights up and talk without slides for the rest of the time about other systems that the Soviets have and the Americans do not. The Soviet Union had a system called FOBS, a fractional orbital bombardment system. Not a very clever idea. They stopped it when they signed the first SALT treaty. And it never hit anything other than the Soviet Union. It sort of went out of Tyuratam and came back round Cape Horn, up over Africa, and landed in the Soviet Union. This was Khrushchev's weapon that could hit the United States from any direction. I think they were quite happy to abandon it. They also have the only operational anti-satellite system, launched again by the same rocket, the SS-9 or the F-1 vehicle. And they tested this a good many times, finishing in 1982, when they declared a unilateral moratorium on the use of anti-satellites, hoping that the Americans would not use the F-15 launched satellite, the miniature homing vehicle. And the Americans haven't done. The Congress used a thing called the Tsongas Amendment to tie the hands of the Air Force and the Pentagon. What they didn't realise was that there was one loophole which the Pentagon seized on, and they actually disabled one of their old Air Force scientific satellites called Solwind, and it's now produced a very large number of pieces. The Americans are still continuing to test their miniature homing vehicle by shooting it at stars, not hoping to hit the stars, but aiming at the infrared radiation from the stars to test the accuracy of that. The Americans have a secret project called White Cloud for using electronic eavesdropping on the Soviet fleet. It's so secret that they were selling first aid covers depicting the system at Cape Canaveral until Aviation Week reported this, and then they suddenly were removed from sale. White Cloud is a satellite which goes around in orbit and has three little sub-satellites in formation behind it. And using this, they can detect the type of ship and also its course and direction. The Americans classify this. They do not issue orbital elements on it. If you want orbital elements, you have to ask David Hopkins, who teaches mathematics in Bournemouth, because he sees these satellites and he produces his own predictions for them, which are very, very good. When there's a sort of a secret American launch, they have a catalogue whereby they catalogue everything which has been launched since Sputnik 1, and we've now reached a catalogue number which has shot up remarkably since last night because of my telex. We're now on to 17,100 and something in the way of satellites. No, I didn't make a note of that, but we're getting on for 17,150 odd pieces. Now, with this SATCAT, as they call it, sometimes you will find two gaps. And if you've got two numbers missing, I pick up the phone and I ring America and I say, you'd better find out about your secret American launch. And so they ask the Pentagon, what was our secret launch the other day? And the Pentagon say, oh, it's a Titan 3B out of Vandenberg at such and such a time, Pacific Standard Time. because they'll tell you that without any trouble, and then you have to wait for them to lodge the orbit with the United Nations. But you can often tell from the time of day at which it's been launched what sort of a satellite it's likely to be. So if I see a white cloud go, I ring up Dave Hopkins and say, we've got another white cloud, I think it's replaced so-and-so. He goes out and looks at night and he generates the elements. Now, the Russians have a similar system called an EORSAT. This is an electronic ocean surveillance satellite, which flies for a period of about 93 minutes. There are two of them, and they pick up the transmissions from the American fleets. And they also have a system which the Americans don't have, called a RORSAT, which is a radar ocean surveillance satellite powered by a nuclear reactor with an enriched uranium, 50 kilograms of that, uranium-235 source, which occasionally they drop over northern Canada. This sort of goes around synthesising an image of the fleets. And the Soviets, I've sat down at tables with them at international conferences, they're absolutely paranoid about the American fleets in the Mediterranean and the Pacific, and the NATO fleet in the North Atlantic. They think they pose a great threat to the Soviet Union, and because of this they maintain they must have their RORSATs. Now, if they're going to use a synthetic aperture radar satellite, it requires a lot of power. More power than you could generate from solar cells, unless the solar cells were so big that the drag would actually bring the satellite down within about 3 days. So granted that they must look at these American fleets with the radar satellites, then they've got to have nuclear reactors. And this is why they're worried about the F-15 miniature homing vehicle, because the F-15 miniature homing vehicle could neutralise their RORSATs, whereas their own ASAT couldn't reach the American satellites. So we have the ocean surveillance type. We've also talked about electronic eavesdropping. These are what we call the E-Link satellites. The one group which I've omitted is the satellite which flies in the Molniya orbit, but whose argument of perigee is about 315 degrees instead of 280 degrees. And these are the Russian early warning satellites, which look for American missiles being launched against the Soviet Union. And they fly 9 of these in orbital planes at 40 degrees. And we've had some of those this year. Now, last night I was asked for a breakdown of Russian launches. First of all, we'll say that we've had 92 launches this year, which may surprise some of you. 2 Chinese, a communication satellite and an Earth Resources spy satellite. 2 Japanese, 2 European, one of which launched the French SPOT, Earth Resources satellite, and a Swedish satellite Viking for Aurora research. So we've got 2 China, 2 Japan, 2 ESA, and 5 American, one of which was scientific, a thing called Polar Bear, which they rescued from the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum and reconfigured to a flight configuration, and they launched it last week on a Scout into an orbit of a 105-minute period, 1,000 kilometres, and if you read the Australian, you think that it sits geosynchronous over the North Pole, because they said it was in an orbit 1,000 kilometres above the North Pole, which to me implies that it stays there, but it doesn't, it really goes round every 105 minutes. We had a Conservative Member of Parliament in the United Kingdom once who said that the solution to the British communications problem would be to have a geostationary satellite over East Anglia, which just goes to say that not only do they not know anything about politics, they don't know much about physics either. So of the 92 satellites, we've accounted for 11, which leaves us 81 Russian satellites. And I've broken them down into categories. First of all, the civilian satellites, satellites which have some civil application. In the manned programme, we've had 5. There was Mir, the new space station. There was Soyuz T-15, which took 2 men to Mir. There was the first Soyuz TM, the new version of the Soyuz. And we had 2 Progress supply ships. So 5 what I call manned related launches. Then we had 2 science launches. One which looked like a spy satellite, but which actually was for a terrible word, there's a Russian word, materialology. Well, I would call material sciences, looking at space processing. And the oceanographic one, which I mentioned, which looks at the ice along the northern part of the Russian coast. So 2 science. And now we come into communications. 5 geosynchronous communication satellites. 1 Ekran, direct broadcasting satellite, broadcasting Russian TV to China, to the Chinese protesters, so they cut the power. It does broadcast. TV straight into the Soviet Union and will be picked up on small dishes about the size of a dustbin lid by small communities out in the middle of the Soviet Union. Two Raduga satellites. Very interesting Raduga satellites. Nobody's ever seen one. I've got a feeling they're nothing much more than Molniers in geosynchronous orbit. But we've never seen a picture of a Raduga. Have we, Mark?
No.
No. And two Gorizonts, two Horizon satellites, which carry various transponders like Volna, Gauss, Luch, and things like that. So five geosynchronous communication satellites. And then we come to the semi-synchronous Molniar satellites. Three Molniar 3s, and one unknown, because the idiots in England who told me about it after I got out of here said it was a Molniar, and he didn't say whether it was a 1 or a 3. And I apologise for my ignorance. I ought to know, but I don't know. So we have 11 civil communication satellites. Weather, or as you would say, meteorology, one. One meteor, the 14th meteor, two. And then we have Earth resources satellites, which could be spy satellites with a dual role. We have four close look ones flying in low orbit, and one which flies at about 350 kilometres, what we call a wide area survey. So five Earth resources, which I've charitably called civilian. Navigation, one civil navigation satellite and one unknown, which is probably civil, but I can't tell until I get back to Kettering to look at my database. So again, I've been very charitable and said yes, this is a civil satellite, which gives the Russians out of their total of 81, 26 civil. If you do the percentage count on that, no, I won't do the percentage count on that because I've worked it somehow differently. Come back to that. We now move to the military one. We have photo reconnaissance. This is the big lot. Third generation close look. Six. Third generation area surveillance. Seven. Fourth generation, which flies for 2 months. Eight. Fifth generation, the first of which was recovered after 238 days, and the second which overlapped it, two. Which gives you a total of 23. But you could add the five civil to that to make 28. Now we come to military communications. One geosynchronous satellite called a Cosmos. And that is probably the one with the Lux transponder on board. So, well, it might be military, might be civil, but I think that probably one's probably military. We've had three tactical launches, eight at a time. So three optical launches. Three store dumps. One of which might have failed, because it didn't reach quite the right orbit, and from which we've had no radio transmissions at all. Or it might not be a stored up, it might even be science. But they haven't said, and I don't believe this. So that gives us seven military communication satellites. Navigation. One triple GLONASS launch, and three definite military Cosmos launches, and that one unknown one, which might or might not be, but certainly four, possibly five. Early warning in the Molniar type orbit, six, one of which failed. ELINT, electronic intelligence gathering, five. RORSATs, the ones with the nuclear reactor, two. EORSATs, two. Geodesy, I haven't talked about geodesy. One, satellites which are up there to accurately pinpoint the locations of continental masses with regards to the other. You see, in an atlas, if you turn over, there's Australia. And it's not linked to anywhere else. And if you're going to aim a missile at Australia, you want to know how far Australia is from Europe. So they have to tie their map grids together, and they also have to look for gravitational anomalies like the equatorial bulge and flattening at the poles and things like that, which will deviate the course of their missiles. So you have geodesy. And three minor military launches. What do minor military satellites do? Well, they keep the Russian ground troops on their toes. Some of them, as they go around, all of a sudden produce four small pieces. And these simulate multiply independently targeted re-entry vehicles from missiles. So that the Russian radar can see four things and can they track them? And you get these radar calibration type satellites. We've had two of those, And another mission which has been suggested is that they use one of these minor military satellites to spy on their own people to see that they are obeying instructions to shut down radio transmissions when American satellites go overhead. And that's not at all impossible. And finally, two tests of the SLX-16 medium lift vehicle, which everyone has been waiting for, which might eventually orbit the little space plane, the models of which came down in the Indian Ocean and the Black Sea. Now, if you draw a Venn diagram of all that and put it all together, you get the overlapping circles. I've got 18 in the middle, which could be military and civil. I've got 10 dedicated civil and 53 totally military. If we take the dedicated military, 53 out of 81 is 65.4%. That's on this year's count by me, 65.4. General Herries, who was an MOL astronaut, is now the commander-in-chief of NORAD, reckoned that there were 75% of Russian launches were dedicated military. Now, there's not a great deal of difference between my 65.4 and his 75, because mine is for a specific year, his is averaged over a lot of years. And if you take the 71, adding 53 to 18, which have a military implication, 71 over 81, if my long division was correct last night at about midnight, is 87.7%, which isn't far from General Herries' 95% total military. What I've tried to do in this short time, which I've overrun by 5 minutes, no, we're late starting, I've tried to deal with the cards for you to play with. I was at the Pugwash conference in Björkliden in the Arctic Circle in 1984, specifically to set out the military programs of the Soviet Union and the United States, and Britain and NATO, because we have communication satellites, and China and France, and OSAT is thinking about, or your Department of Defense is thinking about having a dedicated military transponder on second generation OSATs. So you're not white and white down here. You're thinking about being naughty. Whether you're going to be naughty or not, I don't know. But I said at that meeting, I saw my function as someone who deals the cards for the experts to play with. And it was quite fun, because that satellite, which I told you that the Russians couldn't switch off, I suggested to Alexei Arbatov that that would make an ideal target for their ASAT, because it's exactly the right height for one of the ASAT tests. And it was fascinating to sit there and hear the Russians, who have no military programs at all, talking about ASATs and RAWSATs and photo reconnaissance. And with that, I will leave it to you. If you like to walk out, I will not be offended. If you want to ask questions, I don't mind how many questions you answer, as long as I can get away by about 9:30. Thank you for listening. You appear to be interested. If you weren't, you are very good actors. Thank you.